Are we going? Now, I'm going to talk to you today a little bit about one of my root teacher, Bernie. And you know, when I talk about my teachers, I'm talking about my relationship and my experience of them. Truth, of course, is that all these talks are more about me than about anybody else. And of course, everything you say is also more about you than about anything else. That's who we are. So I'm talking about Bernie and about money. I'm talking about my relationship to Bernie and my relationship to money. The truth is, I don't know that much about Bernie's relationship to money. My experiences with Bernie. I'll tell you something that has not much to do with Bernie first. I've had two experiences in my life that I recall right at this moment of public embarrassment. The first, I think I was about 11 years old, and I went to a sleepaway camp, and at the end of camp, the end of the last night of camp, there was an awards banquet. they used that sort of to help get ready for sending kids home. So they want to send kids home looking clean and neat, so you had to be clean and neat to get into the banquet. There was about 100 and something kids in this camp, in this big barn-like building, which for the lunch meal, I guess, you know, which was the last meal before this last night banquet, and the director of the camp is making this speech about how we all have to get ready for the banquet, and one of the things, everybody has to have their nails neatly trimmed. They're going to check everybody's nails on the way in the door. So you go home, your mother sees you with nice trimmed nails. And up to that point in my life, my chosen method of manicure was to bite my nails. So I want to get a head start on this thing. There I am in the dining room. I immediately start neatening up my nails. And the camp director is making the speech. Everybody's quiet and I'm biting my nails. And he says, "Ken, biting your nails is not the way to do this," or something like that. It was just like, it's like totally humiliating. And it was interesting because I never bit my nails again. It was just like an instant cure. I remember one other experience like this. And it occurs at Auschwitz after the first Auschwitz retreat. And a group of us, I don't know, maybe there were 50 people, maybe more from all over the world who were interested in the Zen Peacemaker Order, which was what we were calling it at the time, who stayed for another couple of days, day and a half or something like that, of discussion at this conference place at Auschwitz after the retreat was over. We had this discussion, and Bernie's presenting various things about the Zen peacemakers, and people are raising questions. I raised my hand and raised a question. I don't remember what the question was, but it had something to do with money and how we were going to fund the Zen peacemakers. It may very well be that I was in some way challenging something that Bernie had said, and I probably felt entitled to do that because I was the chairman of the board, the president, I don't remember what the title was, but I was sort of the head of the board of the Zen Community of New York, which had become the board of the Zen Peacemakers. So I guess I felt entitled to raise some sort of financial question or something like that. And Bernie said something in front of all these people, like, you know, you're raising this question because you have this hang up about money. you know, now, I guess if he had said that when I was 11 years old, he might have cured me of my hang up about money. But it probably came too late to be an instant cure. But he was probably right, of course. And I'd been working on this money issue with him already for a couple of years. And the way I really got involved with it, with him, was around what we call the mala practice. At that time, Bernie was leading street retreats, primarily in New York, and one was coming up, and I wanted to spend time with him, and he said the way to spend time with him is to go on the street with him. He was very busy doing this work of creating the Greyston Foundation and all these social service programs that they were doing in Yonkers. And that was pretty all-consuming for him at that point. But the time that he could just spend with Zen students was on the street. You know, I wanted to go on this street retreat. And the way you got to go on the street retreat was you had to raise a mala. And you had to raise money to support the Greyston Foundation. And the mala was this 19 beads, 18 small beads and one larger bead. And each of the small beads was to represent a donation of $108, and the big bead was a donation of $1,080. And there were people, not me, but there were people who probably could have just written that check for the $3,000, whatever it was, but you couldn't do that. You had to go out and raise this money from people in your social network, friends, relatives, acquaintances. And this was a mind-boggling challenge for me. I had done some fundraising stuff as a work function. You know, I'd gotten grants, foundation grants, and government grants to do mental health programs. But this was always from people I didn't know. You know, there was no personal ask involved in any of that fundraising stuff that I had done. And this mala practice challenged me to ask people who I knew for money. When you ask a foundation for money, certainly you can get rejected. You get rejected most of the time. But it's not personal. Once in a while somebody sends you back a nasty letter that you wrote a lousy proposal or something like that. But usually you get a very sweet letter saying, you know, good luck with your endeavors, we just can't fund everything. It's not personal. But if I'm going to ask, the person who was my best man when I got married, to support my spiritual practice, and he says no, that's a pretty personal rejection. I had to struggle with this, and I think I actually came up with a plan that worked for me. It was sort of a compromise. I wrote a letter. I wasn't asking people, you know, like eyeball to eyeball, and they didn't have to say no. I mean, I would know they hadn't sent money because they hadn't sent money, but they didn't have to say no. They could just not respond to the letter. And I did that, and it was really an amazing experience. My best man didn't send any money, but he did eventually later, years later, but he did. He kind of got on board with this. But, you know, like my periodontist sent a check for $108, and my accountant sent a check. You know, people who I had no idea would respond. You know, and my mother sent a check, my wife sent a check. I think I actually got my wife to Diane gave the 1,080, did the big bead that year. In one form or another, I've continued this begging practice. This begging practice is a big part of a Buddhist tradition, not just Buddhist. You know, maybe every religion, and you know, when you look, you know, most of the money that's raised by charities in the United States comes from individuals, and churches and religious organizations get most of it, and most religious organizations ask all the time. Somebody was joking. At a discussion I was in recently about fundraising, that the Catholic Church asks twice a day. But you know, most religions ask a lot. You know, it's not like once a year. And they raise a lot of money. And we don't do that here. In our group, it's been one of the, although I've been raising money for, you know, various projects, you know, and now mostly for the Verrazano Foundation, as well as just some for Bernie, we don't raise money. We don't ask people to support the sitting practice of people in our group. Our assumption has been that, and we could be wrong, and we could look at this again and see whether people want to create a scholarship fund. But we've basically been assuming that, you know, $5 a week people can pay, and it's voluntary anyway. So they don't pay it. But I've continued this practice, and we started the Verrazano Foundation in 2002, and we've gotten some foundation money and some government money over the years, and a lot of the money has been money that I've raised with these, you know, MALA type letters. I send letters, you know, once or twice a year to everybody I know, and you guys have been helping with the mailings for the last couple of years. We'll do another mailing later, and if you've given me your name and address, you're probably on the mailing list, and you'll get one. What I've become aware of in the last week is two things, which kind of crystallized for me. One is the realization that although I've continued with this begging practice, I've done a trick with it, which has made it kind of easy for me. I've put a lot of time into the Verrazano Foundation. Some of it I've been paid some for, most of it I haven't. But most of what we've done is what we've had the money to do. So if we raise X amount of money, we spend X amount of money. Yeah, sort of what we raise determines what our program has been. And up until now, we've never really, I mean, we've set some goals, you know, like we've set around the arts of recovery, we've said, for a couple of years we proposed a pretty complicated filmmaking project as well as the more traditional visual arts projects. And when we didn't raise enough money to do the video project, we just didn't do the video project. We did the less expensive visual arts projects. So we're never in debt. We're always kind of scrambling, but we're not sticking our necks out. Now we're working on this charter school, and I'm realizing this week that this is getting into a different mode for me in relationship to money. That this is setting up a project in which we can't just do what we earn the money to, you know, we raise the money to do. We can't say, well, I mean, we could, but we can't say, you know, if we don't raise enough money, we won't do the music program. We say, you know, kids are going to get a music art program as part of the curriculum. We got to do that. We have to have the money to do that. We have to have social studies. We can't say, you know, if money doesn't come in, we'll skip social studies. We will pay, you know, we'll stop school early, you know, we'll just go until March if we run out of money. And we can't do things like that. So that the fundraising, begging part of this thing has a different kind of pressure on it for me. And I was involved in in some discussions this week about fundraising that reminded me of what a terrific practice for me this mala practice was, and how it took such a big chunk of anxiety out of my life by just taking this fear of asking and getting over it, because you know, I was real comfortable giving, but I wasn't comfortable asking. I talk about a hierarchical thing there. You know, like, what does that say about my relationship to the person who's asking me for money, who I'm giving money to, if I'm afraid to ask for money? You know, what's that fear about? You know, it's like, there's some sort of hierarchy in there. Now, I became a social worker. You know, I mean, that's just my head, you know, is, you know, being on one side of this exchange. I'm the giver, the caregiver. It's easier to be in that role. And Bernie had talked about that. He had talked about the people who went on the street with him. Almost all of them had had many experiences of giving in their lives, some to panhandlers and many to all different kinds of charities, including to Bernie's projects. And most had never had the experience of asking for money. It changes relationships. It changes you, and it changes your relationship with money. And that's intense. We know that in our group when we talked about membership and dues a while back. And a lot of you are members, but some people were very upset with me. Some people left sort of, you know, how dare you, you know, bring this ugly, dirty money thing into a spiritual room. So I'm facing this week, which is kind of interesting and kind of exciting. It's this kind of big amounts of money. I've sort of gotten used to the amounts of money now. Although when we first started talking about this building up at the Seaview Hospital Historical District that we're going to hopefully renovate for the school, and you know, some of the numbers associated with this thing were just mind-boggling to me. I think one of the first number we were quoted for a feasibility study was $150,000. It's like, you know, it's like, that's a house to me, $150,000. This project, this is a $25 to $30 million renovation. There's a lot of different ways in which pieces of money are going to come in, and we're certainly not looking at trying to raise $30 million in individual contributions. That there's tax credits and all kinds of stuff. But it's a big project, and the school is a big project. And I'm realizing that, and got this idea from another charter school where they got this sort of initial startup money by getting 40 individuals to pledge to give or get $5,000 to $10,000 each. We could do that. That's a good idea. It also occurred to me this week that this is a good practice. Sort of with inflation, the model that I did 15 years ago, whenever that was, probably about a $5,000 model today. And the give or get thing gives it a different kind of flexibility. But I invite you to consider this as a practice. I wouldn't be surprised if some of you will dismiss it immediately as being totally out of the question. It's interesting because that's my experience with a lot of teachings that I've had with Bernie, so I'm not shocked that people have that experience. When Bernie brought up the possibility of doing this first retreat at Auschwitz, we go to Auschwitz to meditate, my first reaction is, why would I fly halfway around the world to sit in silence when I could sit in silence here? You know, and some of that was a money thing. You know, you gotta give Lot Airlines whatever the amount of money was to just go there and come back. Do I want to do that? That's my money. So maybe this idea of raising money and begging, even though it's a very traditional Buddhist thing to do, a very traditional Zen practice. You go out there with a bowl, kind of what you can do on a street retreat. The chance to do this practice of raising $5,000 in a year. Asking people who you know. Different ways of asking. Do letters, you know. I don't know that, you know, I think I'm going to have to do more talking to people now myself. And there are different ways of presenting it. I pitched in the letter a combination of the good work that Grayston was doing. We can talk, you know, I now talk all the time about the good work that the Verrazano Foundation is doing and what an amazing thing the school will be, which will be a prep school for kids with emotional disorders, some other kids too, but primarily kids with emotional disorders to get into college. And I also talked about it initially as, I was asking if this is a way to support my practice, my Zen practice. This is my ticket to go on the Zen retreat, the street retreat. I want, you know, by making this contribution, not only are you supporting this good work, but you're supporting my practice. And I was sort of thrilled with some of the positive responses that I got. It way outweighed the kind of hurt feelings that I had from some of the people who didn't respond. So it just seems like this is a moment to offer this to you. And it's something that hasn't come up before. I haven't seen the avenue for it before, on the one hand, because I don't want you to raise money to support this, our sitting group. You know, we just do it ourselves. I don't want to go ask other people to support this. And on the other hand, it's sort of the way we've done the Verrazano Foundation is we haven't had to set real goals. We just did what we could. And here we find ourselves needing to raise some money. So it's a way for you to connect and support what I'm doing. It's a way for you to be involved in it. Not the only worthy cause, but it is a way to do that. As a practice, I've one of the things that's running through my head is, you know, suppose you said to me, "Well, I want to do this mala practice. I want to raise, give, and get this $5,000, but I want to do it for, I don't know, a volunteer ambulance thing in some place where they don't have a volunteer ambulance thing." I think that's okay. We'll find, you know, the Verrazano Foundation and Lavelle Prep will find this, you know, we'll find the 40 champions that we need. But I'd love to have you guys do that. And this is a great, great practice, this model practice. So I'll open this. We have a little bit of time for some questions or comments, if anyone would love to hear from you.
Commitment, the specific amount that you're seeking?
Yeah, 5,000, 5 to 10,000. People could say, you know, specific, you know, for many people, $5,000 is going to be a real challenge. Some people, it's not enough of a challenge, and they can set the goal for themselves higher. I think in terms of getting. Having the money we need to recruit and train the teachers and stuff like that in the year before the school opens, that if we get 40 people to raise $5,000, we'll get some grant money besides that, and that will cover that.
Because I would think the grant makers would be very excited that you're able.
Yeah.
That you're able to show a commitment.
Forty commitment letters from people saying they'll give or get $5,000 in the next, you know, the next 12 months. I think that's powerful. Found this organization called Saint Hope, which is based in Sacramento and has done some charter schools and other kinds of community development out there. They had this. I think they were started by a retired professional football player. And I think he got people who was able to get some people to sign up just because they wanted to shake his hand. So, okay, I'll raise $5,000 for this. I get to shake your hand. Cool. It's terrific, actually. I think it's a wonderful idea. We're gonna steal it. Yeah.
Do you have materials that we could use?
No, we will.
Letterhead?
Yeah, we will. You know, we will get you all the materials that you need, and that you will be able, you know, and also you can, you know, say what materials, you know, as you think about doing it, what materials you would like. One of the things that, one of the things we'll want to do, for instance, is we'll break down, if somebody gives $100, what this does, you know, in terms of the school, how many books it buys, and, you know, so people know, you know, concretely what they're putting in, a laptop computer, part of this console thing. There's lots of money to be raised in this, and there'll be lots of different kinds of ways of doing it as we move along. And there'll be pieces that are, you know, we'll look for sponsors, you know, for each classroom in the, you know, thing. We could think down the road. I mean, maybe the Zen community will. You know, we could sponsor that like a little meditation room. You know, where kids can go and chill out and stuff. But people can. You know, Yeah, we'll look for people to do different kinds of things. There's a really good opportunity here to do this, asking and giving practice, which is, it's like all these other Zen things, and it's Bernie. Some of you have gotten to know Bernie a little bit, and hopefully all of you will get to know him more eventually. But one of the great beauties of what he's done is to find ways, some new ways of helping people drop off all this conditioning that we bring. Now, what you're going to discover, you're working with me, is that the particular, the tools that he evolved that worked best on me tend to be the ones that I'm most enthusiastic about offering to you. So there are some other tools which, I don't even know what they are right now. But there are other tools which maybe didn't work so well for me, and I'm probably less likely to encourage them. But this mala practice was a great practice. But it's like sitting. If you say to me, can you just explain really how this is going to change my life? I can't. I can just keep encouraging you to try it, and then you'll discover how it's going to change your life. This is a practice which will change your life. Now, that's not every one of you, I imagine. Some of you may already be doing this. Bernie's not the only person to have discovered it. I had a friend who had been, before she left whatever order she was in and became a social worker and crossed my path, she had been a begging nun. She used to sit with her bowl outside Yankee Stadium when there were baseball games. And people on the way into Yankee Stadium would, drop money in her basket. And that's what her order did. So this would not have been certainly aspects of this wouldn't have been new for her. Now, maybe asking your friends for money, maybe that would be. Your relatives. Asking people to support something that's important to you. Some of us have done that often in our lives. Some people run in, marathons and, 5-mile runs all the time where they sign up people, for this firefighter and that firefighter and his family and stuff.
There's an MS walk going on right now at this time.
So, some people have gone out and signed up people on those kind of lists to raise money many times. The more that you've done it, the less revolutionary this is in your life. For me it was a big change. It was a big challenge. If you've done it before, it doesn't mean you can't do it again, but it's not going to be the same thing. Your second session is not, every successive session that you do is not going to be the same experience as surviving your first session. Some of them you may get more out of, and it's still not going to be quite the wow that getting through the first one was. Couple more questions.
Yeah. In Catholic circles, yes. The fundraising is kind of broadened to the concept of stewardship,
mm-hmm.
and they express it as time, talent, and treasure.
Mm-hmm.
So some people may not have a lot of money, but they can be active in terms of their involvement. Terms of their time or particular talents that they have. And I would think that applies
What's different in this, and I think there's something, not to detract from that, you know, and that's, you know, there's a general truth there, and you know, for instance, the school could use all of that. That's true from the school's point of view. From the individual point of view, from the Zen student point of view, that's not true. That we all, if to deal with our conditioning, we all got to deal with our relationship to money. Some of us have been avoiding dealing with our relationship with money for a long time by giving of our time, for instance. That's very generous and may benefit the organization more than the money would have. But in terms of us individually, we're still not dealing with our attachments and our anxieties and stuff like that that come up around money. We may, but we may not. So part of the beauty of this for me as a teaching is that it pushes the money issue. Because that's, now that may be a biased thing, you know, because money was my hang-up. So I needed to deal with that, and I'm still dealing with that, and it's still a productive practice for me to be dealing with that. It was much easier for me to give time, you know, or put myself on the line. It's easier to go on demonstrations. It's even easier to get arrested. It wasn't actually easier for me to get arrested than it was to give money. But it was easier for me to get arrested, like in a civil rights demonstration, than it was to ask for money. Now, you know, this is the 100-foot pole. You know, now we all have some variations on the 100-foot pole, but we got to do the 100-foot pole. So maybe money's no issue for you, say, but you still got to do that 100-foot pole just to make sure. Because when our subjective experience that that's not a problem for me, I could do that, that's not a problem for me, until we've done it, that story in our heads is no guarantee that it's not a problem. Could be a baloney, you know. And I say it's no problem, that's easy, but I haven't done it. And until I do it, I did a bunch of these things, a lot of stuff that were issues for me, all kinds of fears. Going up in a hot air balloon was a big deal. I mean, I hate amusement. You know, I don't want to go to these, you know, amusement parks and fairs and stuff like that, because I find the Ferris wheel scary. Going up in a hot air balloon, scuba diving, snorkeling. Scuba diving is where you have the contained tanks, right? That was pretty terrifying. We all got stuff to deal with. And look, I could do that. I'm a good swimmer. I'm not scared of that. And you know, I still got to do it. And it turns out it is pretty scary. Then I calmed down. I did say to myself, my God, if you know, after all this meditation, if you can't control your breathing, what in the world are you doing? You know, so I was able to sit down on the bottom there and relax. But I was scared. So we do think that this is not, from the point of view of the student, of the practitioner, this is not about each of us has a way of contributing. This is an opportunity to deal with the money thing. Now, it may be that in this give and get equation that many of us don't feel we can give a lot. So, you know, it doesn't matter. You look at, you say, I want to try and do this practice. I want to try and do 108 days of Zen. I want to try and do this give and get $5,000. What part can I give? Can I give $100 a month? Maybe not. Can I give $25 a month? Maybe not. You get down to, you know, can you give $5 a month? I mean, is there something that you're in your life now that you're spending $5 a month on that you could give up? No? Maybe not. What is it that you could give? And then what, you know, what what do you need to get? And then who can you get it from? And, you know, it's, you know, if you, you know, if the $5,000 is too easy, because then make it harder. You know, so that, I mean, you know, I say, okay, you know, I'll ask my father and he can give me the $5,000. That's no big deal. So make it higher. Make it so it gets to the point where if you ask your father to just pick up the whole tab for you, he'll say no. You know, say, are you out of your mind? Say, okay, so what can you give there? So he'll say, I'll give you $5,000. So I don't know, I've got to raise the other $5,000, raise the next $5,000. But if mom is going to give you the next $5,000, then maybe it's going to be $15,000. You got to find out where there's a challenge for you. And see where you're going to put yourself in an experience that's challenging. How do you step from a 100-foot pole? 100 seems like it's going to be a big challenge for anybody. So that's why it works as a koan. It doesn't matter how much money you have, stepping from a 100-foot pole is scary. But in real life, you know, it's like, you know, go to the swimming pool just in a couple of months, you know, and you're a kid. And they got these different levels, you know, so you can jump off the side of the pool into the water. Cool. You're going to jump off the 1 meter board there, but then you got these, you know, 3 meter, 10, whatever it is, 10. You know, at some point you're going to find the board that, you know, you're going to climb up this ladder, and you're going to get halfway up, and you're going to come down again. Okay, now you know where your challenge is. You know. Jumped off the side of the pool, you went off that little board, you know, you went off the... You got to this place. I had a great experience with it, taking my junior life-saving course. You know, so our minds are crazy, you know? So I'm up there, and I go up, and I come down that thing. I have to jump off this tower. I guess it's probably 3 meters in order to pass the junior life-saving thing. Up and down and up and down, up and down. And finally I dove off. You know, so I got all hung up, I can't jump. So I dove. Now diving is much scarier, you could hit your head. But I dove. And they let me, you know, they passed me on that. I mean, I sort of got away with something there. Because the fear of jumping and the water going up my nose or whatever the thing was, I was able to get away with diving. I don't know how I had the courage to dive. We find these opportunities to work with ourselves. And Bernie's, one of Bernie's geniuses is to have invented a bunch of ways for us to work with ourselves. His mala practice that he developed is one of these ways. And it's, in a sense, it's not so different than going out with the begging bowl door to door, and that might work too. But it's a little bit different here to go with your wooden bowl begging for food than it was in rural India 2,500 years ago. This mala practice was kind of something that fit with that. Only you get on the street and you take your old coffee cup and you go out there and you say, you know, buddy, can you spare a dime? And they say, get a job. Then you want to run after them down the street, you know, it's like, I got a better job than you do. I'm a retreatant. Who do you think you are? Anything else? Yes. Yes.
If we are going to do this,
yes.
Who do people make the checks after?
The Verrazano Foundation. It may be that once we have the charter for the school, that people can have the options of doing it either to the Verrazano Foundation or to the LaBelle Prep. whichever way they would like. Let me add one thing, because this is really interesting for me. There's a flip side of this. Which I hadn't really thought about until this week. But I need to have a similar kind of discussion with a lot of other people who are supporters of the school about doing this practice. And I realized this week, this is probably sounds stupid that I hadn't thought of it before, but I need to have the same discussion with them about this.
Who's them?
Other people who have been involved in supporting the school. Not, you know, and what does that mean? That I realized this week, the thought had been, you know, it was basically an economics, finance conversation that I needed to have with, you know, people on maybe on the Verrazano Foundation board, on the board of the school, other supporters of the school, to get help get people to sign up as champions to raise, give or get the $5,000. I realized this week that I need to have the same conversation that we're having. That this is a spiritual growth thing for people, whether my, you know, whether they're dealing with me as a Zen teacher, or they're dealing with me as the leader of a school. That the reason for people to do this is not just that it's good for the school and it's going to help make this terrific program happen and serve these kids who need to get served. That they're doing this, and some of them have done it a lot on other causes, and it's not such a big deal to do it again, but some of them haven't. And for them, it's just as much a spiritual growth thing as it is for a Zen student. And I need to include that part of the discussion with them, which is, you know, why didn't I realize that before? I don't know. But it was really an illuminating thing.
Why is there a need for a charter school? I mean, kids go to public schools, they go to parochial schools.
Yeah, the schools.
I know there's a such a thing as charter schools, but I don't know why.
The overall answer is that the public school system is failing disastrously. That in, you know, in many parts of the city, in particular, you know, areas that are poor, poor and immigrant, some of the schools are disasters. There are schools in the Bronx, for instance, in which 100% of the kids in the school are not reading or math at grade level. 100%. There's no, you know, not a kid in the school is at grade level. That's a disaster. Staten Island is not as bad. Even the worst parts of Staten Island are not as bad as the worst parts of the Bronx or Manhattan or Brooklyn. But what is a problem is that kids with special ed kids, particularly kids with emotional issues, are doing
special needs.
But these particular special needs, you know, it's particular for us and particular for me because that's the mission of the Verrazano Foundation. But the concentration of kids who have the potential to do better, who are doing badly, where you get something like 5% of special ed kids, kids with emotional disorders, in the city schools graduating with a real academic diploma. 5%, where these kids should do as well as anybody else. And maybe better, because a lot of them are really smart. For this emotional, kids with emotional disorders, kids living with mental illness, that the system is failing them as badly as it's failing the poorest immigrant kids in the city. That's unacceptable. What we believe is that the charter school mechanism is a way in which, you know, a group of citizens can focus on an area of failure. And while we can't solve the problem citywide or even deal with all of the kids who might need this kind of program on Staten Island, if we can show that kids with emotional disorders can graduate and go on to college at really high rates, you know, goal is 100%, 95%, you know, we believe the school will do as well as Staten Island Tech, which is right up there with Stuyvesant in terms of the graduation percentages and percentages going on to college. And we can show that there's no excuse for kids with emotional disorders failing, that you kind of stop using this, you know, specialties are in special ed, so what do you expect, right, you know, kind of thing, that's a revolution, yeah, and that will change things.
Could the school unintentionally stigmatize children?
Yeah.
Among their peers?
No, you know, it's
something that, you know, oh, you go to the Looney School.
Right.
Well, sorry.
to address your question, which is a very important question, there's this whole question of mainstreaming in schools, and not any mainstreaming ethnic groups, but mainstreaming disabled kids. And there is an argument, and there's very strong arguments on both sides. That's really the answer. There are some disabled students that are ready and work very well in a mainstream situation.
Mm-hmm.
At the same time, there's the other side of the argument that says, hey, segregate us, because you beat us up, you make fun of us, you stigmatize us, we need to be separate. So, I mean, there's two sides of this argument, and there's both situations where you can make either of those work. And the charter school like this is very valuable because, see, you can set a charter school up like this and you can treat it like it's a magnet school. You can sell it like it's a magnet school, which is what you're saying.
Yes.
Everything you're saying, it treats it as a magnet school. Now, that's a different story. If it's a magnet school for special needs kids, then there's actually the positive side. Hey, I went to the magnet school for special needs kids, and it's just like, it's the Harvard of the disabled.
The other thing we're doing,
you see what I'm saying?
We're trying to get both, I think we're going to get both, the
that makes sense.
Best of both possible worlds, is that the expression?
Right, yeah.
That's the
important. In two ways. One is that 75% of the slots in the school will be reserved for kids with emotional disorders, 25% severe, another 50% less severe. The final 25% of the slots are open. Anybody can come. So, I'm not sure how many regular ed kids we're going to get in the first couple of years, but when we begin to get the kind of graduation and going on to college rates that we get, then I think without a question it's going to be a magnet school for, you know, people who want a college prep program on Staten Island, because the graduation rates and going on to college rates are going to be way above most Staten Island high schools. The other side of it is, in which we get both best of both possible worlds, is that, and I think this is also an advantage of the charter school thing, is that we're not proposing this like as a policy, that this is the way the whole system should be.
It's an option.
You know, so every kid, every parent has an alternative that you can, you know, that if you feel that your kid is doing well and in a mainstream thing, that the stigma is minimized and you don't want to risk the stigma, you can stay with the mainstream option that you have. But you have this other option now, which is, if I leave my, you know, there's some risk that my son or daughter may get some amount of teasing on the block when they find out they're going to this school. But at the end of the day, if my daughter goes here, she's going to go to Harvard on a scholarship. And if she doesn't, she's probably going to drop out of school in 10th grade and be trying to go back to get a GED later on, and who knows if she'll ever go to college. And, you know, what's the stigma and scarring of, you know, because, oh, you go to Lavelle Prep, and what's the stigma and scarring of, you know, you can't pass any tests, and you're, you know, you're 3 years older and 6 inches taller than everybody in your class, and, you know, why don't you drop out?
I might add that I think the children themselves are better at dealing with the stigma issue than maybe the parents.
Well,
because the young children that I've met.
What Ed Knight, who's on our board and is a schizophrenic in recovery, says all the time about the stigma of discrimination, you know, is that discrimination is a much bigger problem. Discrimination is a much bigger problem than stigma. Stigma you can fight back. Discrimination is a little bit harder. So, you know, if you don't have the academic credentials, that's going to have, you know, and you're that's going to impact on your ability to earn a living and the quality of your life. And that's real hard to overcome. Teasing may be painful, but you can deal with that.
Well, this it goes back to the, remember how all the ethnic groups went through the stage where when you were a poor Italian, you were a dago. When you were a poor Jew, you were a kike. But if you're a middle-class Jew, you can handle it. So the point is that with this, the analogy is I've found being disabled myself is with, and I run into all the time, one thing that is a cure, or at least a vehicle to manage your struggle, is your ability to develop your own independence. You know, like with my power chair. When I got my power chair, you could call me a gimp for forever. But with that power chair and my ability to get around on this island, you can call me all the names you want, but it wouldn't make any difference. Because I've got a certain ability, so I know that I'm in control of my own life, and it makes a big difference. Now, when I was in situations where I was confined to walkers and adult homes, those same kinds of characterizations would hurt.
Mm.
And now that I'm out on my own, and I have my own apartment, it's handicap accessible, and I can do a lot more things for myself. In fact, you're less likely even to get those stigmas, because then you get the response from people where they say, I am so surprised that you do so much for yourself. So you start to get a lot more of that, as opposed to some of the stigmas that you're just hopeless.
Go ahead.
Does it make sense?
Yes.
I work with emotionally disturbed kids sometimes. I mean, some of them, some autistic, some multiple handicapped. And you wouldn't dare get stigmatized with emotionally disturbed kids I work with. They would just, you know, they'll whack you. And that would be that, you know. They don't hesitate to fight back. But the thing I was wondering about was the, if you're considering the, you know, here in Staten Island, it's a real big issue about autistic kids. And especially the higher functioning ones, and if you're considering those kids. But I guess that's a different population.
What we thought, we tried to write, we originally tried to write the language of this so that, you know, as we did this stratified admission structure, that higher functioning Asperger's kids could, you know, get into these preferential categories. We ended up concluding that there was, our trying to make up our own category scheme was going to just create a lot of political problems. So we used the state mental hygiene law to make these three tiers. But you know, we believe that higher functioning Asperger's kids could fit really well in this program, and that they, you know, hope that many will come in that open 25% lottery, which is that part of the lottery which is open to everyone. Because my feeling is if you pair a depressed kid and a kid with Asperger's, that's a perfect match. That the depressed kid is going to say, you know, leave me alone, I'm feeling bad, you know. that the Asperger's kid probably isn't going to leave him alone. He's going to keep, you know, coming back with whatever that cheerful question was, whatever it was, till this depressed kid decides to engage. They can help each other.
Right.
the fact is, you know, that we live in this world of compartments, and that we want very much to make sure, you know, in setting this program up, that the kids with emotional disorders get in. You know, and that the risk of just saying, here we got this great program and we encourage, you know, people with handicaps or disabilities to apply, you know, is that the people with disabilities are a relatively small part of the population, and 95% of the slots will be, you know, taken up by, you know, regular kids who want a better education opportunity, and that's legitimate. But we wanted to put this program together to target, you know, this really
poorly served. I answer questions to people's fears, such as, if I send my kid to this school, he's going to be he's a bright kid, but at the same time he's going to be held back by some of the more severe groups. He's going to be taken advantage of. He's going to be his education is going to be interrupted because of their disruption, their misbehavior. How are you going to solve those kinds of problems?
Well, I mean, we have a design for the school which we think kids will succeed in. That we have small classes, we have duly certified teachers, so they're certified in special ed as well as in their academic specialty.
Right.
And mental health services available. We're going to do what we call a wellness curriculum with everybody. And the wellness curriculum is a training thing in learning to self-manage your disability or whatever issues you're dealing with in your life, which is something that's beginning to be done now with adults, but still isn't done very much with kids.
Right.
You know, in part because we're pretty much afraid of kids self-managing in general, you know, so, and you know, once you put a label on the kid, then, you know, oh my God, can we afford to have an emotionally disturbed kid deciding what's best for him? My God, you know, we need to be deciding what's best for him. But kids need to be able to take charge of their lives. That's going to be a great thing for everybody. You know, for all the kids, it's a big advantage. It's kind of, you sit here and do what I tell you is a horrendous education design.
Right.
The other thing which we know and has been researched over and over again is that when kids are challenged academically, the behavior problems decline.
Yeah.
When kids are not challenged academically, the behavior problems increase. It's kind of across the board. You know, it happens with kids who have the most serious emotional issues. It happens with kids who are, you know, under good circumstances would be symptom free. You put them in a boring school with boring pedagogy, they will become oppositional, defiant, and delinquent, and school refusers, and
regardless of that.
Yeah, right. I mean, you know, it's like putting kids in prison, you know, putting people in prison. You know, if you put them in a bad situation, they'll get worse.
Yeah.
We need to stop, though. I really appreciate all the feedback. I really would encourage you to think about this on a variety of levels. Chris's point earlier, I mean, the school can use all kinds of stewardship. So there's other ways of being involved. If you use Zen practice, think about dealing with money. This is great for me.
I need the time to do it too.
Yeah.
So it's in there.
Yeah. It's all there, and we all have work to do on ourselves, and I think that's part of the. That's another beauty of Bernie. You know, Bernie's always working on himself. He's always stretching.
Always challenging himself.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah, that's obvious. Just that last book of his, I read it, and it's just obvious. He goes out of his way to make the challenge there, so that he's always evolving, you know, in his practice. You get that sense of how he sees that it is that it's pure process with him. I mean, it's amazing how he's able to do that. I mean, I've served just a few people that have the capacity to do that. I he does.